Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason, and today we are talking on our audio podcast with Glenn Reynolds. He is a professor of law at the University of Tennessee and is better known to everywhere over the world as the founder and proprietor of Instapundit.com, one of the first, biggest, and still best aggregator sites of commentary, links, and you name it. Glenn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you are in the news recently. Rather than talking about the news, you actually created news in North Carolina a few days ago when protesters pissed off about Keith Scott stormed an interstate. A local TV station, WBTV, tweeted, "Live now, protesters on I-277 stopping traffic and surrounding vehicles, avoid, watch live." You retweeted that with the three-line word, "run them down." What happened next?
Well, it should be known that was against the context of a whole lot of reports of violence and rioting, not just protesting in this event. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what set me off with that tweet. So honestly, nothing happened right away. I tweeted that, I think it was 8:51 p.m. at night, read my book, went to bed. Got up the next morning, opened my email, and people were like, "Why are you banned on Twitter?" And I was like, "I have no idea." And it actually took me a while to figure out what had happened. But over the night, while I slept peacefully, it had somehow exploded. I think a bunch of lefty sites bombarded Twitter. And I'm still honestly not sure whether I was just automatically suspended by a bot because enough people reported abuse or spam or whatever, or whether there was human judgment involved.
So before we get to that question or whether or not we can answer it, what did it feel like? I mean, as somebody who obviously you have a life in meat space, I know, you know, I've seen the pictures, I've met you in real life and all of that. But what, you know, was there an emotional impact to suddenly, you know, being cut off from Twitter?
You know, it was mostly puzzlement initially. And of course, one of the problems is when people don't like something you say on Twitter and they get you suspended, then you can't respond. You've been not only silenced, but sort of neutralized. So once I figured out what was going on, mm-hmm. which I actually found out from a post on Twitchy, mm-hmm. I posted something on my blog, which basically said, look, I wasn't saying run down peaceful, innocent protesters. I was saying drive through these blocks of people who look like they're trying to kill you, and which I saw as a fairly crucial difference. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was... That was what I put on my blog, but then I had to fiddle with Twitter. Eventually, I found an email from them that said if I clicked on a link and followed some instructions, I could get my account restored, which I did. They required me to delete the tweet, so as soon as I got back up, I put up a link to Twitchy that preserved the tweet so nobody would think I was trying to hide stuff. And then it was just a matter of dealing with all of the anger that stirred up and the misinterpretations or...
So talk a little bit about that, because as a longtime reader, and I think somewhere I've posted you were involved, or I quoted you actually one of the very first things I wrote for Reason, a short piece about the Lopez decision going back to what would it be 95.
Yeah, that was something I wrote for Cato back in 94, I think.
But in any case, I wrote a defense of your free speech. What was your intention in saying run them down? Because Twitter, when you look at the terms of use, they say, you know, basically any incitement to violence and a variety of other things is grounds for being banned or suspended. What were you intending, and how was it misconstrued, if it was misconstrued?
I wasn't intending enough, to be honest. I mean, what was really happening is I was lying on the couch with my phone, retweeting stuff and occasionally commenting on it. And if I had thought about that for 5 seconds or even three, I would have said what I meant in a way that wasn't so exciting. Mm-hmm. But I just didn't. And, you know, that's one of the dangers of Twitter. And I've always been aware of it. And, you know, I have over 580,000 tweets. And I guess statistically, the odds just caught up with me. Right.
And this is the first time that you've been suspended or blocked.
First.
So what was your if you had taken, you know, more than three words to what was your intention or what was the message that you would have said?
I would have said something like, "This is awful. Don't stop for these people. It's too dangerous." Mm-hmm. You know, I might have said, you know, "Run them down if you have to get away." But I wouldn't have said it in a way that made people think, or in some cases, I suspect, pretend to think that I was saying target these people just because, you know, you can.
Do you, and there were reports of cars being kind of hit and vandalized or
windows windshield like smashed. You know, there was a woman on the phone with a local TV station who was a truck driver whose truck was being looted and was scared for her life, she said.
Now, you know what's interesting is that as a law professor and as somebody of a libertarian bent of mind, and just as a side note, do you consider yourself libertarian, conservative? Do you use a different descriptor that fits you best?
I consider myself libertarian. I mean, there are so many different flavors of libertarianism that the most important thing you do as soon as you consider yourself libertarian is announce that nobody else is a real libertarian like you.
Yes, that's right.
But that said, yes, you know, and that means that I'm a believer in as minimal a government as we can get. And, you know, I sort of, when I talk about my policy preferences, sometimes people are surprised, but I have to explain to them that, you know, there's sort of the theory of the second best. There's the situation I would have if I controlled everything, and there's the incremental policy thing I would do next that I hope will make things better. But yeah, I'm certainly not a conservative. I mean,
One of the things I was going to bring up is that you have been critical, and I know that you've linked certainly to a lot of Reason stuff and Radley Balka, both when he was at Cato, when he was at Reason, when he was at the Huffington Post, now at the Washington Post, talking about the militarization of police and police abuse. You have issues about the surveillance state and things like that. And I'm not saying that you're a super you're totally in on any kind of negativity towards law enforcement by any stretch. But, where do you see the country going with these questions about Black Lives Matter protests? Or more broadly, there is a real concerted and heartfelt and I think meaningful pushback against some of the ways in which police have been doing business for decades now.
Well, you know, the biggest problem with the police is not that they shoot people sometimes, because that's inevitable with their job. It's not even that they shoot the wrong people sometimes, because that's kind of also inevitable over time. The real problem with the police is that they are perceived, and I think it's a correct perception, not to be accountable when they shoot the wrong person for the wrong reasons. And it's not only that. I mean, they're not perceived not to be accountable for a wide variety of misdeeds. They're perceived that way because, in fact, they get away with a lot.
Yeah. And what's driving that? Why do police get away? I mean, I know we've run stories about this. I know you've written stuff about it. You're also, besides being the proprietor of Instapundit.com, you are a regular contributor to USA Today, where you write a weekly column that is pretty wonderful. I try never to miss it. But why do cops get away with stuff that you or I would not get away with?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is they're sort of a paramilitary organization, which, you know, means that camaraderie and esprit de corps are a big part of what they do. And that basically boils down in real life to covering for your buddy. Mm-hmm. And since cops typically control the initial reporting and gathering of evidence in an event that happens, it's pretty easy for them to protect each other that way. Then second of all, prosecutors depend heavily on the cops to do their job. And they know that unless a case is truly egregious, the police will be angry if they prosecute a police officer. So they're inclined not to. And then, of course, jurors tend to be pretty sympathetic to cops, too. So even if they do prosecute them, the cop has a pretty good chance of walking. And on top of that, they're usually unionized. And so they have a lot of political protection. So that's a pretty good recipe for getting out of jail free most of the time.
Mm-hmm. To bring it back to Twitter and free speech. Now, Twitter you're a libertarian of some sort of flavor. I think I'm a hot fudge sundae Pop-Tart style libertarian.
I'm a low carb libertarian.
Okay, yeah. So you're a paleo. Well, not a paleo libertarian. Maybe paleo diet libertarian, but
yeah,
not
that's
yeah.
It. What bacon libertarian
do you does Twitter have the right to ban people that it says, you know what, for whatever reason, I don't like your speech, get the hell off of my platform?
Yeah, generally speaking, sure. They're a private company. They're not bound by the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that's a little tricky about Twitter is that they're a publicly traded company and they tell their investors as well as their customers that they don't censor, but an awful lot of people who paid close attention to what they do conclude that, in fact, they come down much harder on people on the right.
Than
they
do. Broadly construed right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the non-left, I guess you could say, you get away with a lot more if you're on the left.
Well, you know, a recent kind of cause related to that was Milo Yiannopoulos, the Breitbart editor, alt-right kind of figure, was banned.
Is Breitbart London or Breitbart Tech or both? Yes. I'm not sure. Yeah,
and
not the U.S. Breitbart.
He was suspended or banned permanently for life after tweeting various things at an actress, and that led to heaping amounts of racial abuse on a black woman. Do you think, is that good? Is that bad? Should Twitter be more wide open in letting people duke it out? They do have a series of tools that allow people to block or to avoid seeing things they don't want to see. Is that enough, or should they be policing themselves?
I think they should do less policing and give people more tools to protect against being trolled and threatened and such. That would certainly be my preference. The other problem that makes it a little rougher is, and this is not just Twitter, this is sort of all the social media stuff, it's all kind of a semi-monopoly. I mean, it's a small number of companies that really control almost all social media, and they all kind of lean left. I mean, Facebook has been accused, and I think, again, quite credibly, of having a lot of political bias, and they've done experiments that suggest that they could swing an election by manipulating their flow of news and views. And, you know, at some level, you say that's just private enterprise. Right. They can do what they want. But at another level, it's a little more troubling when they are kind of a monopoly and they're politically in the tank with an administration that is doing them a lot of favors.
What are the favors? And let's fixate on this a little bit, because it is an interesting question, especially from a libertarian perspective. Twitter does not have, I mean, if to the they have great market share. They don't have a monopoly on social media, on free speech. Neither does Facebook, even though these are the, they're beyond the McDonald's of, whatever McDonald's might be to fast food restaurants or Walmart is to retail. These guys are even bigger. You're not saying that they should be forced to kind of enforce a fairness doctrine or anything. You're arguing that it is for the benefit of public discourse that they relax a little bit and let people speak more freely? Or
I mean, I'm not even sure what a fairness doctrine for social media would look like, but I wouldn't if I figured out what it was, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be for it. I'm not so sure that we aren't approaching the point where people might want to think about antitrust. I know we're past the point where if these were companies that operated with a slant toward Republicans, everyone would be calling for antitrust regulation right away and talking about the horrible dangers of this. But what they really are is they are quite demonstrably, and there's been a lot of reporting on this actually, in bed with the Obama administration. I mean, Google people have been meeting at the White House all the time. Mm-hmm. And they're also being very lightly regulated by the Obama administration. They get breaks on everything from taxes to immigration. And that really does make you suspicious when it also looks like they're sort of slanting stories in a particular political direction.
By the same token, we know that Twitter, Facebook, Google, eBay, that they have been forced to, and I don't think it was quite willingly, but they've been forced to cough up huge amounts of data or to allow, kind of vacuum cleaners on stuff.
Yes.
So are they, I mean, is... Let's to put it slightly differently, are they in bed with the Obama administration for ideological reasons, or is it that they also realize that the federal government, can do whatever it wants to them and can, Microsoft, going back 15 years or so, Microsoft had been doing pretty well, and then they got a major antitrust suit against them that tied them up for years. I mean, are these guys quaking in fear, or are they marching arm in arm with a kind of liberal or progressive ideological agenda?
Well, it's probably some of both. I think it was Al Capone who said you get more with a kind word and a gun than a kind word alone.
Yeah.
And, or the Mexican drug lords, I think they're something as silver or lead. They will bribe you or they will kill you. So I think coercion and favors kind of go hand in hand in these kind of things. But it's definitely, I think, kind of troubling. I mean, mm-hmm. and I have to say, I wrote about this a few months ago when I was criticizing Twitter and such. In the early days of the blogosphere, we had a lot of independent blog sites. And that was sort of a drag for some people because it was relatively hard to set up your own website, even if you had to set it up on Blogger. like sites like Facebook or Twitter make it much easier to just log on and start putting your views out. But on the other hand, now you're on somebody else's platform and they have control.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about that because, you know, and we are talking to Glenn Reynolds. You know him both as a University of Tennessee law professor, a USA Today columnist, and perhaps best known as the proprietor, the founder, the Internet's Instapundit at instapundit.com. And this is the Reason audio podcast. You can find us at iTunes, on SoundCloud. Go to reason.com/podcast. We also have RSS feeds, both for our audio podcasts as well as our videos. Talk a bit about that. The Wild West of the Internet, it was probably dead by the time you started Instapundit in, I believe, August of 2001. Are we, you know, is it that the Internet now and that, so you started, you know, Instapundit is 15 years old. Are we so domesticated now? Is this kind of, is it a mature industry almost where that early spirit of kind of free speech and of flame wars and where people would say the most horrible things and it was kind of expected, like that seems to have been banished from today's internet? Are we in a kind of corporatized, bureaucratized, snowflake world now?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, if you want to think about the role of sort of Twitter management or whatever, it's basically they're like the HR department for the internet now. That's not that appealing to me.
Yeah. What do you think? Here is a question that I come back to often. And I say this as somebody, I've been working at Reason since 1993. When I joined, it was definitely part of the alternative media because there was a very big gulf between sites. You know, we're based in L.A., or, you know, part of us is, and our headquarters is there. The difference between Reason and the L.A. Times was massive. Nowadays, we've had Matt Welch, my colleague, co-author on the Declaration of Independence, actually left Reason and worked for the L.A. Times and then came back to Reason because it was a more vital institution. things have really changed. But do you feel like freedom of speech is simultaneously, it seems that we have more and more ways of getting our messages out there, whether they are good, bad, or ugly, but there is also an ever-increasing attempt to control and regulate speech?
Yeah.
Is this just kind of, are we Sherlock Holmes and Professor Moriarty falling over Reichenbach Falls forever and ever, infinitely, or are we winning? Are we losing if we're on the side of more expression rather than less expression?
Well, you know, I actually wrote a column a while back on this, and my sort of tagline was speech is freer, but people are less free. And that's sort of how it is. There are lots of ways to get your message out, but the powers that be are, and also, honestly, a lot of your fellow citizens are just a lot more comfortable about punishing people and silencing them.
Yeah. Do you feel, and this is something I guess it's not a proprietary secret for Reason, but I'm sure you've seen this a lot in your own traffic. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, I'd say Instapundit was probably our single biggest traffic source or one of them, you know, and you have done an incredible job of aggregating. And I think in the post I wrote defending your freedom of speech, I say, you know, Instapundit is the first or second site that I check every day after Reason. It's that central. But nowadays, most of our traffic referrals come from Facebook. Then Twitter is second. Do you find that Facebook and Twitter, and I suppose, we're getting into an area where, you know, places like Instagram and Snapchat supposedly have more daily users than Twitter, that you have been displaced as a first order aggregator, even if your traffic is still strong? And does that worry you, not because the government is suppressing speech, but to kind of go back to what you were saying, these other bottlenecks or these gatekeepers, you know, new gatekeepers are growing up in a world that was once kind of a big sky country for whoever showed up?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, it's my traffic continues to grow. It doesn't grow as fast as it did in those heady early days, but it goes up every year. A lot more people are on Facebook. And my own experience is that Facebook drives a lot of traffic and Twitter doesn't drive that much. Somebody was saying in my comments that he posts recipes and people never follow the link to the recipe. They just look at the picture. Whereas Facebook sends him a lot of traffic. He says it's just amazing the difference. And that's kind of my experience. But, you know, yeah, I mean, people still suck up to me for traffic, but it is, I guess that's in part because you can't really suck up to Facebook for traffic. You've got to market it out there somehow.
You know, and if we knew where to suck up, I suspect we'd be doing that. But we are talking to Glenn Reynolds. He's the Instapundit, and you reminded me in terms of the traffic. You still see people talking about the Insta-lanch, what happens when you would get a get an Instapundit link. And I can remember early days at Reason where we would actually have our server break down under the strain of too many people coming. What happened with the University of Tennessee? You also had some fallout from your tweet that got you temporarily suspended from Twitter. What's going on there that you can talk about?
I can talk about everything. It's all over. The University of Tennessee sort of took them a little while, but they came out with a statement that my speech is protected by the First Amendment and, you know, not even worth considering any sort of disciplinary action. And I was gratified to see that. They actually got the initial announcement from my dean said something about an investigation, and that set a lot of people off. And they actually heard a lot from a lot of alumni who were very angry about that. And I think they thought by sending that message out they were going to please the alumni. But it turns out the alumni of the University of Tennessee are pretty big fans of free speech, and actually a lot of them read Instapundit. And they really got a pretty substantial pushback. I was just talking to somebody today and discovered it was much bigger even than I had thought. So I think that played a role. But I also think, you know, Tennessee has a green light rating from FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. That's the best you can do. And they are actually pretty proud of that. They brag about it when they testify to the state legislature, and the state legislature seems to care about free expression on campus. So I think that helped too.
What makes Tennessee, University of Tennessee in Knoxville, which is a wonderful college town? I've driven by there several times and spent a little bit of time there. What makes it unique about among university campuses? Because to hear, you know, FIRE doesn't give a lot of green lights out, and you know, most of the stories we hear, and you certainly write a lot about higher education, is that you know, the lights are going out all over academia. What makes Tennessee a kind of more vital bastion of free speech and free expression?
Well, you know, that's actually a good question, and I think it has to do with the politics of the state of Tennessee. I mean, Tennesseans are just fairly sensible people, and kind of, you know, I wouldn't really call Tennesseans libertarians, but they're kind of small government, don't mess with me conservative types that kind of overlap with libertarians a lot, and they're just sort of very well grounded. So I think that the latest PC fads just don't have as much traction here, and I think that makes a big difference.
As a final point, let me ask you, you talked earlier when you were talking about libertarianism and your kind of version of libertarianism. There is the big, you know, kind of if you were the king of the world, of course, you would renounce your crown or make everybody co-equal, and we would have a glorious utopia of utopias. But in, you know, short of that, you go for the next best thing. Who are you going to vote for in the election? Have you made a decision, and on what grounds do you decide? Are you going this way, that way, or possibly a third way?
You know, to be honest, it doesn't make any difference in Tennessee. this place is as far from a swing state as it could be. It didn't even make any difference in the Republican primary. So I don't know. You know, And actually, I think you and I were going back and forth on this on Facebook earlier. I'd really like to be more enthusiastic about Gary Johnson, but I feel like in this really special year for libertarians, he might not have been the best public face. Now, maybe I'm wrong. He's polling better than libertarian candidates have done in the past, you know, but
tremendously much more so.
He may appeal better to people who aren't longtime libertarians than he does to people who are. And I may very well want vote for him if I can bring myself to vote. But of course, it will make no difference. But actually, maybe that's a reason to vote for him, because I can vote for him and raise his totals and help him out and have a completely clear conscience, because my vote won't make the least bit of difference anyway.
Are you a you're certainly a never Hillary. Are you also a never Trumper?
No. Here's the argument for Trump that I find a little bit hard to dismiss. And it's not an argument based on Trump being good. It's just that everybody in the establishment hates him. And I'm not saying vote for him to stick a thumb in the eye of the establishment, though I got nothing against that in general. It's that a President Trump will be very constrained by the media, by Congress, even by Republicans in Congress, by sort of the deep state and the bureaucracy. Whereas the Hillary email scandal kind of and stuff really indicates that Hillary just isn't constrained by anybody. So if you had to choose between Trump and Hillary, even if they're equally bad, and maybe even if Trump is inherently worse, I think he's likely to do a lot less damage because of that.
Yeah, that's one of the things that is always hard to game with politics, particularly presidential politics, is it's an ecosystem question, right? If Bill Clinton had managed to get ClintonCare through in his first 2 years and won a bigger majority in 1994, et cetera, like, you know, the 90s probably would have been very different than he yes. managed the unthinkable, right, which was to elect a Republican Congress that actually kind of acted in a small government fashion, at least in certain instances.
Yeah, better than they've done. Better than the Republican Congress that Obama elected somehow.
Yeah, no, it's this is the for me the libertarian optimism is things can always get worse and they do, right? Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Glenn Reynolds, the University of Tennessee professor of law, who was recently suspended briefly from Twitter. Read about it at instapundit.com. He is the internet's first one and only instapundit.com. Glenn, thanks so much for talking to Reason today.
Thanks for having me.
For Reason's podcast, I am Nick Gillespie. Please check us out at iTunes, SoundCloud. We have RSS feeds up the wazoo. Go to Reason.com podcast to subscribe. Please rate and review everything that we do. We like to hear the feedback, whether you're happy, sad, or somewhere in between. Thanks so much.